Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sunday of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time. So you just have to make your time translations across the country and across the world. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. Wow. And that's just the United States, folks. I can't even imagine what that number would be if we calculated the entire world. But most folks, frankly, don't even know about brain injury. And I didn't. I never did. Not until it came to live on my doorstep. So on Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. So on the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I also host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And then on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neurofatigue, anger, or any other of the various symptoms of brain injury. And believe me, there are many. I think I've done 120 some shows already, and there will be so many different topics that you can find when you go to the archives to listen to them. So just a little bit about me. For those of you who might be new to my show, this is just a snippet. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005 when my husband David had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog. And this is where I always remember, folks, have a pencil and paper nearby, because I will be throwing out some URLs that you might want to look into later after the show, not now. So anyhow, it's survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, all one word, all lowercase, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show, starting in August of 2014, the last of which in November of 2014 featured a discussion with David himself. I also interviewed David on my April 10, 2020 show for his perspective on his brain injury after more than 15 years of living with it, and because he is a retired professor of microbiology from Columbia University, I wanted to get his understanding of COVID-19 and how people are, you know, how they're addressing the pandemic. So you can find my archive shows on my blog again at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click on the air show menu. And there's a tab under that section on the right sidebar, so it's really easy to get to. And that's where I said all my shows are archived there. So it's that's the easiest place to find them. Let's see. Or you can type David Fragerski if you want to know more just about David or more about COVID, because he actually has a category about COVID that he writes for. And as a scientist, he breaks down that scientific information into layman's terms so even I can understand it. So give that a try if you want to have some valid information that's going on about COVID. You can also read our complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing and released 2 years ago. It's already had its second birthday. It was released in November 2018. And you can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as an ebook and as a print book in all your local book haunts. And also, don't forget to look online, too, because, of course, you can find the ebook there. And guess what? I have been saying this over and over and over for months. The audiobook is coming. It's going to be coming. Guess what, folks? It's here. The audiobook arrived, I should know the date, I guess, but it arrived within this week, so maybe about 4 days ago. So I'm really, really excited. So you can find that on Amazon, of course, Audible, and iTunes. So check it out. It's a great holiday gift, either the book, the ebook, or the audio. So check it out, folks. And if you do read it, please write a review. That is a book's report card, and it's how it stays alive. And we need these kinds of books in our community to help each other out. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. And I hope tonight that you're going to find my show fun and informative. And I hope that you'll visit the shows of other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 Pacific time. And you can also tune in on most weekend nights at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time for shows. And that would be Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays to listen to favorite shows, too. The Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States, all 50 states, countries. And you can not only find it on the Brain Injury Radio Network, you can also find it on Spotify and various other platforms. I'm not really sure all of them, but you can check it out. So now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. So today, I want to talk about brain injury, of course. So a traumatic brain injury causes more than bodily harm. It also causes emotional and behavioral traumas, along with the physical injuries of brain injury. There are often many unseen conditions that greatly affect a survivor. Falling into extreme emotional or behavioral states can be debilitating, and it can interfere with daily living. So tonight, I'm very pleased to say that my guest is Dr. Alana, and she is an expert in identifying and redefining trauma. That's right up this alley, folks. So Dr. Alana is not only a speaker, an educator, an effectiveness coach, she is also the author of her book, Wake Up to Your Brain, Biology, and Behavior. So tonight, I just want to start right in and say, Dr. Alana, welcome to the show. I'm so pleased to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, great. I've been waiting for this all week. So I'm going to just jump right in and ask you, I want to know what you were like as a child and as a teen before we get into all the nitty-gritty of all your business right now. But how did you realize that delving into the psyche would be your life work?
Well, as a teen, really as a child, I would probably say that my parents found me a bit rambunctious. I asked a lot of questions. My mom called me 20 questions because I always wanted to know why. And that probably was the most common way that people would describe me, is just always wanting to know why. I read a lot. I read encyclopedias. If you didn't tell me, that's why we bought the encyclopedias, because they got tired of answering my questions. They were like, go read about it. So I was a straight-A student from that standpoint, but I was a behavioral problem. I was a pretty tough teen, if you will. I think by the time I was in my teenage years, I was really very close to being a juvenile delinquent in a lot of ways. But thank God for, you know, just maturity and learning things and having experiences that made me really have to decide, like, how do I want to live the rest of my life? Because I can see the fork in the road literally in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got kicked out of school in eighth grade. And my mom was like, okay, what you going to do? You know, you say you want to be a doctor. That does you're not behaving as intelligently as we know that you are. So that really was my first major fork in the road, was just deciding that I was going to put my my big brain into learning about the human body and just understanding what it meant, what it did. Yeah.
Yeah, wow, that's great. You know, it sounds to me like you needed Google. But obviously, you know, can you imagine looking? I mean, we have the encyclopedia in our home, too, you know, and
yeah.
All those 24 books or whatever it is. I know some letters Q and R were always put together, so it wasn't a complete 24. But, you know, yeah, they took up a lot of space, and we, you know, I did use them also. But look at all the advantage the kids have today. You want to know
mm-hmm.
something? Press a few keys, and up it pops. Wow.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Good for you for just, you know, persisting in finding out what you wanted to know.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. So, Dr. Did you have anything else you wanted to say on that? I don't want to cut you off.
Well, actually, I guess I was going to say that I think that the important thing about that journey for me and getting into psychiatry was that I had to start asking the type of questions that are uncomfortable to ask as a psychiatrist. And that's how I think my bigger journey actually came after I had been practicing psychiatry for several years and realized, like, I don't think we understand trauma very well.
Uh-huh.
And that was actually a devastating part of my journey when I realized, like, I'm very good at what I do, but what I do is missing so much information about trauma that we have so many people that are being misdiagnosed and misinformed. That was actually probably my biggest fork in the road.
Huh, interesting. That gets me right into my second question. I found your keywords, redefining trauma, very interesting. So can you discuss that?
Sure.
What do you mean by redefining trauma? And you kind of alluded to it. We don't have the information about it, so.
Right. So I came out of medical school in 2011 out of residency in 2011, and I took a job at the VA. It was my first job, really it's been my only clinical job my entire career was at the VA. And at first I was on the outpatient side, which was in the trauma recovery program, where I was seeing patients with depression and anxiety and PTSD. And then associated with those experiences was usually substance use and some eating disorders and some behavioral addictions. And you know, we had those clusters, traumatic brain injury, all
mm-hmm.
of that within the trauma recovery program. But after about 3 years on that side, they noticed, like, hey, her patients do really well. She's great at treating PTSD and personality disorders, and we need a doctor for this inpatient specialty program. And the program was called the ROVER program, Returning OEF, OIF, OND, Veterans Environment of Recovery, which is ROVER for short. And it's Iraq, Afghanistan war veterans who you have to have gone through combat, you have to have a diagnosis of PTSD, and they come in for a full month, and they get 12 months worth of treatment in that month. And that was probably the most transformative experience, because as much as I was teaching them, I mean, I was spending the whole day there with them, really literally there at work
mm-hmm.
with them, And then, of course, with Congress and everything, I had the privilege of also doing the women's unit, the WISER program. And then I jumped around from learning a little bit about what the psychologist did, what the social worker did. But the bottom line was when I was learning with the veterans, but I also had
right.
the benefit of understanding their biology in a way that they didn't even understand it. And so I got very good at hearing the patterns of trauma when people would talk about it, and I started to feel like I'm hearing it everywhere. Like,
mm-hmm,
why do I hear trauma in places where, you know, the bar says that this a relationship trauma can't be psychologically traumatic, but yet here's this person having what would be PTSD symptoms if it was about anything else, but it's about his relationship breaking up and the violation that he experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to ask myself, like, well, you know, we know that the DSM-5, our diagnostic Bible, if you will, I don't like that term, but that's what people say a lot, is that's how mental health practitioners use this to diagnose. But even from that standpoint, I know it's an imperfect document made by humans with blind spots. So I said, what's the blind spot here? And the blind spot was the bar for trauma is not being physically violated or experiencing something physically happening to your body. That is traumatic, but trauma can also be someone calling you a name, or some
mm-hmm.
are failing at a role, or a failing in something that you really want to do in life. It can be someone passing away that you care about. It doesn't have to be a sudden or untimely death, which what deaths are not untimely, but, you know, from the experience of
mm-hmm.
other people, you know. So once you really start looking at it, you're like, wow, there's a lot of psychological invisible trauma that we're not even giving voice to. So TBI,
yeah.
I think, is a great example of it. How does it make sense that every person who experiences a TBI, traumatic brain injury, meaning your skull got thumped, however you know,
mm-hmm.
however severe or mild it was, your brain has been shaken around and has experienced damage. How can we not be also helping people understand you also experienced a psychological trauma? The way you think
mm-hmm.
is going to be affected, your emotions are going to be affected, and your behavior is going to be affected by this, and that is because it affects your brain. And we need to help you not only with the physical part, but also with the thoughts and the emotions and how that those cause your actions. That should be a part of every person's intervention and conversation when
mm-hmm.
they've experienced a traumatic brain injury. How did we do with that in your experience?
How did we do it? Well, you know,
how did medicine do?
Yeah. It was ignored. I wasn't, David had most of my husband's issues are physical, not cognitive, not emotional or behavioral. And so we feel very, you know, happy about that. But in the beginning of his, when he was still in rehab, yeah, he did have some issues and he did talk to a psychologist at that point. And she assured him that what he was feeling was normal and he was able to put it into perspective and move on, which was fortunate. But that isn't the case for most people. Most people are having this thrown at them. They don't understand, especially with a brain injury. They don't understand why they're feeling the way they're feeling, why their lives are so turned upside down, why they are angry now when they never used to be angry, why they are confused, why they are, they're losing they don't have the proper memories that they had before, they can't retrieve them. So there are just, I could go on and on, but there are just so many things that people aren't understanding, and they're left to figure it out pretty much on their own, unless
mm-hmm.
they have the wherewithal to get help.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I really started pushing more of a skills over pills approach. And it truly
yes.
was born from the the unit that I was on, most of the time I was trying to get them off of medication or get their medications leveled out so that they could think more clearly and they could be more really psychologically and physically connected to what was happening in the moment. So for most people, you know, when I was learning therapies like dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive processing therapy, anger management therapy, and some of these therapies that we give to people when they reach what we would call endpoint treatment, like they've had so many other interventions that we're going to give them these, I started learning those and I started going, my goodness, like this is interesting information. I thought I understood these things, but as I even watched myself, I realized we're not doing a very good job in medicine of educating people about their body, their biology, how their thoughts help to create their emotions, and how your emotions create these powerful urges to do something or say something or not do something or not say something when something probably needs to be said, that they are contributing to a huge amount of behaviors that we are not even fully aware of because we're not taught about our brain in detail. And I believed that it, when I began teaching my veterans who traditionally, I started to notice this cluster of symptoms, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, borderline personality disorder, and some substance that they've used to cope. And it started to annoy me because what I saw was trauma after trauma after trauma after trauma after trauma has built up in this person, and now they're so wound up that their body physiologically is interpreting things through this lens and then acting it out in these huge spaces because they don't have the language to express it. And if only we had a better understanding of these powerful urges, we could probably do a better job of controlling them, right? And when I would teaching people about that instead of, and maybe not instead of, but along with the traditional methods, they were getting better. They were having progress so much faster. And I said, okay, we must be missing something.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, I watched your video at the Women's March 2020, and that's where I learned about your model, Skills Over Pills. And that makes so much more sense. Medical doctors want to pass off the pills to you constantly. In fact, David was taking something like 15 pills when he came home from the rehab hospital, and they were altering him. They were altering his personality to a point where I thought, wait a minute, something's not right here. And eventually I weaned him off of the pills with the doctor's knowledge. I didn't do it on my own because I think that would be scary. But
sure.
I said, look, he's got to come off these pills. I don't want him on this. I don't want him on this. I don't see that he needs that. And after discussing it with them, we did get to wean him off the pills. But so, yeah, we took away the pills, but we didn't put in the skills, you know, that fortunately David is, intelligent enough that he can figure out many, many things on his own. But, you know, there are people that need that guidance. And I think that's what you're talking about, and that's where you come into play. But can you talk about how one can use mindful actions to overcome trauma?
Sure. So I think that one of the things that we are not taught is how to wrestle with our brain and with our thoughts. You know, I explain to my, I don't have patients anymore. I say really, other humans, I don't even have clients. I'm like,
okay,
we are the same. Physically, we are 99.9% genetically the same. Every human being on earth, no matter the body, the culture, the ethnicity, the gender, even the brain injury, you still have the same basic physiological structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also have an invisible part of ourselves. It can't disappear. It can't be sold. It can't be lost. No matter what happens to you, it doesn't go away. We have thoughts. We have a mind. We have emotions. And we know that those things, even though we can't put our finger on them or touch them, we know that they're present in every human being. So we are creators at all times. We're all here attempting to navigate the experience that we exist in, but also we're sitting in our own biggest blind spot. We can all see what everybody else is doing a whole lot better than we can see what's going on in ourselves. That's just how humans are designed. But from a mental standpoint, we have a tendency to spend a lot of time thinking about the past, which often makes us depressed, or worrying about the future, which also often makes us anxious, and not spending a whole lot of mental time tuned into what is my physical body doing and feeling in the current moment, which is really the only moment that you have full power over in the now, right? So, just by the nature of our biology, our brain runs us around all over the place mentally. And much of our mind is, I describe it as, you know, the machines where you stick people in and they'd have to try to catch the money and the wind turns on and the money's thousands of dollars in there. And the person steps out and they've got $3 in their hand. Because our thoughts are so chaotic and very quick. We think thousands of thoughts a day. We think on average between, 70 to 100,000 thoughts a day. And that's if you sleep at night. You know, there's a lot of people don't sleep that well. So, you know, imagine how much energy that brain is taking up. So mindful action is really about learning how to slow down and learning how to put your body in neutral and really think, what are my thoughts and how are they affecting how I feel? What are my emotions and how are they affecting what I'm about to do? Because you are have to really become responsible for what you produce. That's the big take-home message, is that when those emotions, for example, we all have an amygdala. Every human being on Earth has an amygdala, and it's the part of your brain that generates your emotions. And it doesn't generate your emotions based on a factual reality. It generates your emotions based on what your brain is interpreting and translating into your body. So if you've had a car accident, when you get in a car, something that may have felt safe before might feel very scary now and affect your ability to drive as safely as you used to or drive at all. And that's your amygdala that's creating that physical experience inside of your body. My opinion is that we should have learned about that in first grade, second grade, because not knowing that you have this invisible thing, it's never at rest. When you think you're not feeling emotions, you're either calm or you're numb to your emotions. And so by that just simple definition of that amygdala and what it can do, mindfulness is difficult because our default is loud and busy and negative. And so we have to learn how to settle our brain and our body enough to access the prefrontal cortex, which is the part behind your forehead, which it often can get damaged with traumatic brain injuries and cause people to have trouble keeping their amygdala in check because they don't have the part of their brain as engaged that can help to that would say, no, we're not going to do that thing. We're not going to say that. No, we're going to calm down. If many traumatic brain injuries involve more than one area that gets shaken up or get injured, depending on where the injury is. So one thing I want to make sure that I say is that it's also important to recognize that traumatic brain injuries are not all the same, of course, because depending on the area of your brain that may have gotten affected most, You know, your husband has had a was probably blessed that maybe the areas of his brain that are intact and working well were able to keep him learning how to able to relearn again how to keep that control level, where someone else may have an experience that that area may have been become damaged some and need a bit more attention or time to heal. So I just wanted to point that out.
Now, and one of the things you mentioned is like every brain injury is different. I focus on that and I stress that on almost every show because brain injuries, if you think about a snowflake, there's not one snowflake that is like another snowflake, nor another fingerprint the same. And that's exactly the same as what a brain injury is like. They are not the same. Even if somebody got damaged, say, for example, in the frontal lobe, it depends on where the damage happened in there, where or if they got hit in the frontal lobe and maybe again on the occipital in the back or the parietal at the top of their head, then it's going to cause a different damage. And because the brain is such a complex organ, that's why there are no two the same. There are just too many parts of it that can be affected. So
That's also the challenge that medicine has now, because I definitely think we give too many pills. I know certainly there are situations where the pills are necessary and useful, but there is a point of too much, and I think that that is more so if we can find the balance. I think that we will have a much better opportunity to help people who just can't, like, you know, take all those pills. There's so many circumstances that those medications might start working against the progress, but even stopping the medications, but if there's nothing to help with the behavior, and like you said, we might take away the pills, but if there was definitely a reason why whatever was going on that the person was trying to get some help. So we have to really all come to the table and be willing to acknowledge, like, maybe we had some things that we haven't quite done well. And maybe if we do those things and own that we can improve our education of patients and family and caregivers and give them tools that are internal versus external, that we would need less of the external crutches.
True. I agree with you totally. I just want to do a station identification here. You are listening to Another Fork in the Road on the Brain Injury Radio Network with me, your host, Donna O'Donnell-Fogurski. And tonight I am speaking to Dr. Alana, who is not only a psychiatrist, she's also an expert in identifying and redefining trauma. Dr. Alana is a speaker, an educator, and an effectiveness coach. And she's also the author of her book, Wake Up to Your Brain, Biology and Behavior. And, I listened to it, and it's great. So I just wanted everybody to know who we're talking to right now. So, Dr. Alana, you talk about framework of understanding the mind, body, and spirit of humans. Can you talk about each component that makes up AIM and how each is helpful to brain injury survivors or their caregivers? And I won't go through it. I have them written down here, but you know them better than I do, so why don't you go ahead?
Well, I think really where I come from with AIM Up is I want to give people strategies to help remember and use skills that can pull them into really using that prefrontal cortex deliberately. And so, as you may also know, when you have brain injuries, it helps to use tricks and mnemonics to help your brain just keep track of things more. And so this was born of my veterans so that they could remember to stamp these things in their mind and work their way through it as they find themselves in challenging situations. So the A is awaken to your identity, awaken to the fact that all of us are creators. And when I say all of us are creators, what I mean by that is, you know, I've had the blessing of being a psychiatrist and listening to so many people tell me their trauma stories. And even as you were pointing out, with every brain injury is unique, every human being is unique. Every human being and what they've been through and their experience, that's what I love about trauma, is that PTSD is never the same story depending on who's telling it. And when you begin to understand that, even when you go off, even when you don't remember what you did or what you said, you are still making things. You're still creating things. Your thoughts in your mind, when you think them, they create your things inside of you, sensations you may not even fully be aware of. Your emotions are powerful, and the whole time that you're doing things, you are creating. And we've been taught that the things outside of you are what cause you to feel that way, but that's part of the reason why I teach the brain biology, because inside of your mind, inside of your brain, there is a computer that is making calculations and judgments at all times to help you mm-hmm. make your way through this world. So you are a creator by default. Nothing that happens to you changes that identity. But the I, we have to be informed about our biology. We only really have 7 parts of our brain that we really need to understand in order to really get some of these biological urges and behaviors that we have difficulty understanding. And I teach those 7 parts of the brain in my Trauma Recovery Institute because they're so essential to be able to recognize, because they color how you think every day. So this is like, you are like a Klingon technology, but you're just pushing buttons because you don't, mm-hmm. you haven't been taught about the parts of your brain that generate these, a huge part of what you think of as your personality or what you think of as yourself. And so the M is become motivated to practice skills to be more effective with your thoughts and your words and your choices, so that you're more likely to create a better outcome in whatever it is that you do. And so using AIM to remind yourself that you have to upgrade the way that you think about yourself and other people in order to accomplish this. And what do I mean by upgrade? I mean that if all of us have been taught that we are that it's really important. You are a animal, human, and a spirit. You have physical biology that will help to dictate your psychology and what you're thinking and how you're making your choices, and that you are going to live the experience of those choices every day. So you need to know what parts of you are running the show. I think we would probably have a better world. I'll say it like that. So aim up, mm-hmm. everybody.
Okay, it sounds like a good advice. Now, you mentioned a site that they can go to learn more about this.
Yes.
Do you have a URL we can throw out?
Yes, ma'am. It is da-tri.org. Dr. Alana Trauma Recovery Institute. That's da-tri.org, and that's my nonprofit organization where I spend my time and energy putting fun, interesting content about the brain, body, and behavior, and just providing skills and other opportunities for people to learn more about how these things work.
Yeah. And yeah, definitely. If you look up Dr. Alana on the web, I mean, I did this week as I was preparing this interview with her, and I found so many interesting things out there, and I just was hitting buttons from here to here to here, and just going everywhere. So yeah, all of you who are listening out there can do that too, and learn so much information just on the things that she has put up on her website and her inner posters. So definitely try to do that, folks. It's fun. So I want to go into into a, something about, you mentioned the Iraq War earlier and PTSD and the troops coming home. So, and it's actually, to me, it's no surprise that thousands of troops from the Iraq War have returned home with remnants of the war lingering on in their lives. Troops are often afflicted with that PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. It's believed nearly that there are about nearly 500,000 troops are affected with PTSD. That means nightmares or flashbacks of the war are some consequences of PTSD. And that can seriously affect how a person reacts to his or her life because the nervous system has been altered. The flight or fight feeling takes over. Relationships are often affected. Behavior can change. Social withdrawal may occur, and feelings of anxiety are prevalent. And I can't even, you know, you can just go on and on with these kinds of things. So I was wondering, Dr. Lana, for 12 years, you treated military veterans with PTSD, including their symptoms of anxiety as well as trauma-related conditions. What kinds of symptoms were the troops displaying, and how were you able to help them? And I'm just hoping that maybe our listeners might be able to identify with some of these things and be just know that they're not alone. And I just want to make a disclaimer here, folks. We are, Dr. Alana nor I are giving any medical advice on this show. We are just making discussion of this, and you can take the discussion for however it can help you in any way.
That, yes, and I'll take it even a step further and let people know that I am no longer in clinical practice, so they don't have to contact me and ask me if I can be their psychiatrist, because I cannot be their doctor, but I am a doctor that teaches, and they certainly can become a student. So I'd love to answer that question, because it's very misunderstood that, first of all, any person who has to go into a war zone or go into a place of significant unrest at risk to their own life is affected by the experience. You sort of one of those you can't swim in the water and not get wet kind of thing. And
exactly.
the way that they're psychologically affected is that your brain has to learn to scan the environment and look for danger and look for behaviors that may indicate that something dangerous is potentially going to happen. And that happens to every person over there, whether or not they ever held a gun or shot a gun. If you have to go into a combat theater, you're going to experience moments of alarms going off, attacks happening, maybe that don't necessarily directly affect you, but there's lots of people who feel like they're not allowed to, I guess they can't call their experiences traumas because they don't have the things that they think add up to PTSD. So let me throw all that out the window by saying the experience itself, baseline, is traumatic. And then you can add other things to it that may have happened to you or to your body or to someone you know, or maybe not even to someone you know, but someone that you might care about or even care about them just as another human being. Like you may see a dead body of a person or a child, or you may hear about or learn about horrific circumstances that affect the way that you think. And rightfully so, your brain makes adjustments to adapt to being able to call an environment like that normal. So when our, not just our troops, but people who live in those spaces and the troops on the other side, but when anyone who has to participate in war behaviors has to come back into a civilian zone that's supposedly safe, although America has some gun violence and other violence problems that make their fears more valid. When you come back into this space, that doesn't change your brain. You've been trained into a way of thinking at the risk of death if you don't think like that. So catching a flight doesn't change what your brain has been taught to do. And unfortunately, we have no real process that acknowledges that or validates that for the people who come back, because it's often, I think the last statistic I saw was almost 5 years in between when people would return from these deployments to even being able to get into some kind of mental health treatment. And, you know, debriefing when you come out of the military, it happens. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's not sufficient to address the psychological changes that your mind has undergone.
Mm-hmm.
So what it really boils down to is people being able to recognize PTSD has four components: re-experiencing, which doesn't have to be nightmares and flashbacks, although it can be. It also can be your body reproducing the sensations even that you felt that may come out of the blue. So you may not have a nightmare that wakes you out of sleep, but you may experience panic attacks when you smell a certain smell that your brain associates with the burning smell after something that happened, but you may not have a conscious concept that that's the trigger. You just suddenly may have a panic attack, or suddenly may be feeling anxious or nervous or depressed or whatever you felt in that moment. So the second part is the avoidance. Avoidance is you start to change patterns of behavior. You might start to change, like, I'm not going to talk about this thing, or I don't want to bring up any of my time in that military, or I don't want to bring up that experience that I had. Just we don't want to talk about it, you know. So certain topics may become off limits. Certain places may become off limits. Like, I don't want to go there. It reminds me of that. Or certain activities. I don't want to be in crowds. Crowds make me feel overstimulated and anxious. And sometimes, you know, the human brain is amazing at justifying anything. So you may not realize that those behavior patterns are changing, because your mind can justify it based on, I don't like the way that makes me feel, so when I don't like to do something, I just stop doing it, you know. And so people may find, even without realizing, that their life is really changing because of their avoidance. The third component is a persistent negative effect on one's thoughts and feelings. So a distortion of how the world is interpreted. So that can be, I'm constantly finding the negative in everyone. That can be paranoia. That can be extreme, like when somebody might say, oh, why do anything? There's no point in doing anything. We're all going to die tomorrow. You know, we're all going to die eventually. And using those as justifications to not enjoy life anymore, or not really fully engage in life anymore. So you find that some people might be able to identify more with, like, a person who constantly hones in on something negative, or finds the negative or pain point of anything and points it out, might constantly critique, or constantly just not able to get enjoyment out of things they used to enjoy in the past. And so that persistent negative thought, that's the third part. But the fourth, which people often forget, is that PTSD comes with physical re-experiencing as well, physiologic changes, because your stress hormones, I mean, if you think about it, if you're doing more negative thinking, then you do more negative feeling. You have more negative emotions, you might be more irritable, you may be more snappy, you may be more likely to go off or get into an argument or yell and do something that you know, lands you in jail or in a fight or divorced, you know, or other negative consequences, because they're so wound up tight like a spring. And the more negative things happens, the more that spring winds and winds and winds until, boom, you know, that can come out explosively. Yeah. So the being on edge, being jumpy, being jittery, those are all physiologic or body manifestations of your brain constantly thinking more, trying to protect you from horrible things happening again. But that negative focus also means that you may find things negative that are not negative, and you've never been taught to make the distinction between what your primitive brain will show you and what is actually really happening in a shared reality, if that makes sense. So I hope that's that's a long description of PTSD, but I hope that kind of hits the point so people can understand it.
No, I think it was a great description of it. And I have to tell you, too, you know, when you were talking about all these different things, it brought to my mind that at one point, many years ago, I was sitting at a stop sign, actually, and I saw a child get hit by a car and was actually underneath the car. And I was affected by that in what I think is probably a PTSD kind of situation, where I would wake up in the morning and I'd be in a panic and I wouldn't know why right away until I realized, oh, my God, it's because of this. And even during the day, I would still feel that panic. So I understand how it can be out of control for you. But, I mean, after time, for me, time took that panic away, and it's not always in my mind. But in the very beginning, it was, and it feels horrible. You know?
Sure. And I want to be clear that most people actually have, if you have something traumatic that you experience, you usually have a predictable pattern of changes after a traumatic experience that we should all know about. But for most people, your brain will start to habituate that away. But some people, the brain, especially if they have more traumas, it will continue to bring it back over and over again and, like, show it to the person like a snapshot, like a camera snapshot.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's got to be really horrible to have to live with. And I know a lot of people through the brain injury community that have to deal with PTSD because of various reasons of their brain injury or something that happened to them because of, you know, being hit by a car. For example, every time you see, you know, a bicyclist or something like that, you're like, oh, it brings it back. And so, So that was a pretty grim topic. So we're going to try to uplift us a little bit. And I just want to talk about that so many people are seeking happiness. And I guess we all are. I mean, that's pretty much our goal in life, is to be happy. But happiness sometimes seems elusive. And it's hard to find, and many times we think we see it, but so often it's just out of our grasp. I like to think about landing the perfect job. You know, that's something you think, oh, that's going to make me happy, or finding the right guy or the right gal if you're in the market for a guy or gal, but or making your first million. Then you'll feel like, okay, that if I get that, I'm going to be happy. I'll be completely happy. And there are so many happiness goals like that. But often what's weird is even when the goals are attained, happiness still seems out of reach. So can you talk about why folks so often place their happiness in goals that are unlikely to be reached?
Sure. So I really love the topic because it very much ties into trauma, because even though it seems like PTSD and trauma are such a grim space, the answer is actually much more accessible than most people realize. And so what I would say about happiness is that I think, first of all, what we need to understand is that humans are an emotionally incompetent species. And I'm going to say it again. The current humans alive on Earth in 2020, we are collectively an emotionally incompetent species. And what I mean by that is that there is so much pervasive misinformation out there about what our emotions are and what it means to have them and how they are even generated, that it would be very difficult for anyone to realize that happiness is something that is entirely self-produced inside of their own body based on how they teach themselves to think about things. So let me back up a little bit. So
okay.
Even to this day, I still find so many people, including psychiatrists, and I even have to catch myself, mental health professionals, other doctors, friends, family, educators, no matter what the education level, that will still say things like, their emotions come from the heart. Like when you say something loving, that you're saying it from the heart. That's how I, that's a common expression that we learn. Well, the heart is awesome. I love the heart. It's a wonderful organ. It is very important. If you don't, if it's not working well, you are in trouble. But your emotions are decided in your brain. That's where they're decided.
Right.
Your happy ones and your sad ones. Mm-hmm. All of your emotions, your love, your joy, your peace, your happiness, also your fear, your anger, your jealousy, your envy, it all is coming from that same system, a part of which the amygdala, I mentioned that little part earlier. The little bitty bean-shaped area of our brain is producing our emotions. And we have messages like men are not supposed to have emotions.
Right.
What else? Some of my favorite myths are like humans are not supposed to cry. If you cry, you're weak, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are, that's three common emotions, emotional myths that are prevalent in our society. So because we've been taught to not only ignore emotions or think that we don't have them, I mean, I can't tell you how many people have been like, you know, I don't have emotions, or I'm not emotional. And I'm like, oh, what is that right there?
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about what emotions are. So, and I say it, and I include myself in it, that even as a trauma psychiatrist practicing in my field, it took me going through my own personal traumas to recognize that I still didn't really have a full understanding of my traumas as well and my emotions and how they were affecting my decision-making. So our happiness comes from inside of us. It is very difficult to maintain that that state of happiness in a world like ours right now, but it's not anyone else's responsibility. But unfortunately, we live in a society where they show us fairy tales about what love should be like and what marriage should be like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we learn about love through songs and TV and shows, not very much through our parents and other people in our life sometimes discussing it with us in a healthy way. You know, so I think emotions and being happy really has to be about people doing their internal work to create their happiness in their life intentionally and not putting it on other people. Like, you made me mad. No, your brain is interpreting this situation is what's making you mad. Let's talk about what emotions are underneath that anger.
That's interesting. It's almost like the I statements. You know, not you made me mad, but I am mad because. So figure out why you are mad. We were taught that as I'm a teacher. And that was one of the things that we were taught early on in early education is, you know, you don't make the you statements. You make the I statements. So because that takes responsibility for what it is. So the other person didn't make you mad. You became mad because of something. And what is that something? Why? You know, so it's interesting that you have to delve into your own self to figure out your own self, basically.
Yeah, what am I saying to myself that's making me feel so anxious? What am I telling myself about this scenario that's making me feel as paranoid as I am, or that I'm under threat or that someone wants to harm me? What am I telling myself about the scenario that could be responsible for how I'm feeling internally? Because anger is an umbrella emotion. There's always other emotions hiding under anger, and we just have not learned how to talk about them, process them. Like when we start talking about things that have a lot of emotion in them, the conversations don't tend to go well. We have a tendency to, you know, I don't see many examples of people having calm conversations, disagreements where they can say, I understand your perspective. Thank you for telling me where you're coming from. I don't see very much of that happening in the examples
that we have
in our household. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you on that. Have you ever heard of the movie In and Out?
I love In and Out. It was one of the movies
that we
showed on our unit to help us understand these powerful emotions. And I learned some things from In and Out.
I've watched it 3 times and will probably watch it, you know, tons more. And I like to share that movie with as many people as I can, folks, so you can find it on Netflix or Primetime or whatever. Just look for the movie In and Out. And it's an animated movie that, you know, takes you on a train through your brain of your emotions and how when the train goes off the track, which our brains do often, how they have to repair the track or how they have to store the memories or how they have. It's just an amazing movie. I'm so glad you know it. I'm so glad you know that.
Yeah, it is a great movie, and it's really useful. Yeah, it's very useful for helping people to also recognize that we need all of our emotions. I can't tell you how many times people have said, well, if it's the amygdala, why can't I just get rid of it? You know, like, can't we just get rid of these things? My emotions feel like they're tormenting me. The roller coaster that I go on makes me want to, you know, kick the bucket, get off of this earth. And, you know, I think sometimes I certainly, based on what people tell me, their life experiences, like, I'm like, that's valid. I can get that. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the more that we embrace having our times where we allow our emotions to inform, not only inform what we say and how we say it, but to be more clear about how we're feeling, if we try to explain it to someone else, it helps us get it. You know, like how many times do you need to just talk something out with somebody else and you're like, oh, I didn't even have the words for what I was thinking or feeling, but now I found it. Yeah. So we have to learn how to use emotion words and not avoid uncomfortable topics, but be able to say, I am feeling this and it's causing me to, you know, I'm feeling jealous and I'm trying to explore what about this is making me have these sensations, you know, and then it might be the other person's behavior, but it also could be my trauma trigger, and being able to recognize the difference between that sensation that, you know, and not treat my feelings as if they are fact allows me to have more control over you talked about the mindful action. Mindful of, I have a very powerful, invisible sensation going on inside of me. It's making me want to say, wait, that's primitive. you don't want that version yet. Whoa, hold on. Aim up. Let me awaken to myself. I have to be responsible. I have to be informed about how I'm feeling on the inside, and I have to be motivated to use better skills to say what I want to say, because if I don't, the default is the primitive. The default are these warring, aggressive, fearful, animalistic parts of our brain dominating what we create versus the version that you really want to experience, the positive, the happy, the peaceful, the healing version that you want to have.
Yeah, so definitely. So for anybody out there, write that one down, In and Out. Find that movie because it does just take you through it without being real scientific, but it makes you understand what your brain is really going through. It's, you know, and it really brings to light why you might be feeling some ways and why things are not working the way you thought. So check it out. And if you do, actually, I think I have a blog post on my website, blog site or whatever it's called, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just put In and Out there, and you can probably catch a link right there from it and find out a little bit more about what I said. So, Dr. Alana, I want to hit on another topic before we end up having to run out of time, because this is flying by as it usually does when I have a great guest. So I know that you're a proponent of empathy skills, and that is something that many of us need to be retrained in. I think that most of us learned empathy as we grew up under the tutelage of our parents. But as I see the world today, and you mentioned that earlier, I think somehow empathy skills are not high on many folks' lists right now. And I loved your quote, retraining the brain is the beginning of all trauma recovery. And you talk about empathy skills and practice heals. So why is empathy so important? And how can folks tune into their empathetic side?
Well, I love that you said it that way, because that I don't have to even sell the idea that everyone has empathy already naturally within them. And it's something mm-hmm. that we come born with. Children, babies are naturally empathic, naturally empathetic, naturally emotionally connected to other people and able to see and feel with other people. That's the reason why when a toddler usually see someone crying or looking sad, they'll go over and pat their back or even start crying with them, right? Even a baby, if they hear another baby cry, they start crying with them. So it is something that is trained out of us by our life experiences, those painful times where maybe even your parents trying to prepare you for a tough world might do or say things and teach you incorrect concepts about yourself and emotions and other people that then cause you to experience psychological trauma that you may never even recognize. So the reason that I say that empathy is important is because that's just the first level of empathy. Empathy is not a light switch, it's a dial. And empathy can be deepened and really taken all the way over into the concept of experiencing the world through the other person's ears, through the other person's perspective, through what the other person knows and understands, not what you think about it. You're not putting yourself in the other person's shoes, because, you know, when we put ourselves in the other person's shoes, we have this tendency to go in with our judgy selves. I love it when people say they're not judgy. I'm like, it is literally part of your biology to make judgments. We draw judgments and conclusions on a regular basis, and you most definitely are judgmental. It's biological. However, we can put our own judgment to the side and be able to say, what would this experience be like in this other person's reality? And then their beliefs are just as important and just as powerful to them. Their experiences are just as painful to them as mine are to me. And humans have this really nasty habit of not really caring about something unless it's touching them personally or people that they may be close to, right? Other than that, if I can't really feel it inside of my own body, like, well, you know, that doesn't bother me when you say that, so it's fine, right? But the other person is over there calling into the radio station like, oh, you said this and you said it this way. And it's like everyone's interpretation is going to be different. And it's valid. We don't have to agree on it to be able to say that you're drawing the interpretation or the conclusion that makes sense to you in your brain. And that's really where empathy becomes healing, because you begin to understand other people differently. You begin to recognize where you may not be quite as much of a pearl to be around as you think you are, you know. You may not be communicating as clearly and lovingly as you think that you're being from inside of your personal shell. You have to be willing to consider that I know I'm saying these words, but they have to travel out of my brain, out of my mouth, across space, and be interpreted through that other brain, whatever that brain has been through. And those words will have a different meaning to that person. They might have a different interpretation. They've been through different experiences, so they will reference different things. So while it may look like we're having the exact same experience, it's completely different. And that's where empathy is powerful, because that puts us all into connection with each other.
You know, and I totally agree with you. And, you know, our time is running out, and there are so many things here I wanted to talk to you about. But I can't, because we have to go off at a certain time for the next host to come on. But I'm just going to say healing cycle and called love. So, folks, you can look that up on your own. Take notes right now because I can't get to it all. But you can find out some more about this information on Dr. Alana's website. So healing cycle. And it's called LOVE, and that's an acronym, and you can read about what that is. There was something else. I'm just grabbing my notes right here before I get to ask you my last question. It was a biggie, too.
And we definitely can do a part two.
Yeah, okay, well, then maybe I should save these because, I'm fascinated by all the things that you're talking to me about. Empathy skills practice, an ESP. I can't talk about it now, but folks, you can look at it, and maybe that's something we'll come back and discuss. And so my last question before I have to go into my housekeeping duties is, Dr. Alana, we are more than 9 months into this pandemic. It's a very trying time for everyone, I am sure. But how seriously does the isolation and quarantine affect those who are living with a brain injury and are already so compromised? And, you know, do you have any suggestions for those folks? Well,
yes.
I mean, this is for everybody,
and I'll try to
really.
I'll try to make it as quick as possible, but first I think it's really important to validate that the coronavirus is a global psychological trauma.
Yes.
Every person has been affected in some way, shape, form, or fashion. And so actually verbalizing that, allowing yourself to have a bit of a roller coaster and be gentle with yourself about it. It's okay that some days you may feel like, wow, I really have so much energy, I could take over the world and I could do my new business project. And then other days you may barely feel like getting out of the bed. That's normal. That's fine. We're having a major trauma. So the first thing is to validate that the trauma is actually happening. But I think the most important thing that we can do for people who have traumatic brain injuries is to really be intentional about finding positive coping skills. So meditation, mindfulness, activities like brain games that can help the mind stay exercised, physical exercise, whether it's some people can't do a lot of physical walking, but cycling, or even there's chair exercises that you can look up online. Whatever you're capable of doing to physically move your body will be helpful. Time outside in nature is also going to be really helpful, and music, especially music from it could be an era that they really love or a type of music that they really enjoy. And then also look for new things. A lot of times people get stuck and they go, oh, the best times were back in those in the 50s, and you can go, yes, that's great too. Let's do the 50s, and let's look for even newer stuff that you might like so we can do a combination. So those are just some examples. Try really hard to decrease use of things like alcohol, tobacco and cigar smoking, cannabis smoking. It's really easy to tip over into our habits that we don't think are too big of a deal until they bite us in the butt. So plugging in intentional positive coping skills. Okay.
And that is a great ending, plugging into positive social. Say it again because I just got it wrong and I said it was good.
Let me see if I can remember. Plugging into intentional, positive self-care activities or positive coping activities. And there's lists of them all over the internet.
Okay, I got you on that. That was good. Perfect ending for that. So I want to thank you so much. But let me just go through my ending thing here. So I want to thank Dr. Alana for sharing so much information and actually offering help to so many people out there listening. And I'm really so excited that you were on the show today. And I definitely agree. I can see a second show in the future. Yep, I can. So You can learn more about Dr. Alana at her website. And can you just give me that again? I should have written it down, but I didn't. It's Dr. Alana. Is that true?
So there's, I have two websites, dralana.com, which is dralauna.com, and my online trauma recovery institute is it's the letter D, the letter A, dash, the dash sign, tri.org, dash tri.org, pronounced the try, like we're trying to get better, so we're going to try
right.
to get better together.
Okay, and I was there, I just didn't write it down, and that was not smart on my part. But anyhow, please check out my blog, Surviving Traumatic Brain Injury, to learn more about brain injury, and there I do a lot of interviews of survivors and their caregivers. So you can find, read their interviews and see that you're not alone out there. So many people have gone before, and unfortunately, if their words can help you, that's what we're trying to do. There's also a section there called guest blogger. So if anyone out there wants to be a guest blogger, just contact me at Donna O'Donnell Figureski at gmail.com, or just look me up on anywhere. You Google me, you're going to find more than you ever wanted to know about me. So please, I hope that you will read Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which is my story that was released in November 2018. And again, remember, the audiobook was just released this week. So think about it. On my next show, it's going to be in our new year, 2021, and we can only hope that it's going to be better than 2020. However, I am not so certain about that, but we'll just keep on with the positive thinking there. And, so then at that time, we're going to be talking about how we all fared through the holiday season and what we're looking forward to in 2021. So before I, as always, I always like to say, if you liked my show, tell 10 of your friends. If you didn't like it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So as the clock is ticking up to 6 time, folks, we're going to have to say goodbye. But stay tuned to the next show with host Matt Duffin. It starts at 7 p.m. Pacific time, and I will see you on January. And this is where I always have to go look at my calendar. You think after 120 shows I would remember to go check it out. January 3rd. Holy moly, is that it? January 3rd. Yeah, it is. I thought it was going to be a different date. I'm surprised. But that's when I'll meet you again, right at this same time, same station. So, so that's basically what I want to share with you tonight. So, Dr. Alana, I wanted to say thank you so, so much for being here tonight. It was a joy. I enjoyed talking to you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. The pleasure is all mine.
Okay. So, okay, folks, we'll see you all. Don't have a happy and safe holiday, whatever holiday you're celebrating. And if you're not celebrating any holidays, go for it anyhow. Still stay safe and healthy. And I will see you in 2021. So good night, everybody. Take good care. Bye-bye. Good night, Dr. Alana.
Good night.